we're going to do a show.
Sorry. You know, Paul's my brother, so we have to goof around a little bit. Dr. Huntington, your needed stat in the sanctuary. All right, let's get started. How's everybody doing? Are you exhausted yet? Are your energy's good? Ready to go? All right. So this is going to be fun because the goal of this session is to kind of tell you a little bit about how we talk about single payer. And then we're going to do a little fun interactive thing, which is stump the presenters, or as Paul likes to say, stump the chump, where you think of your hardest questions that you could possibly get asked about single payer, and we'll try to answer them, and then you get to decide whether we've done an adequate job of that. And if we haven't, then the person that asked the question gets a prize. So let's get started. If I can have, is Jason up there? Can I get the projector on? There we go. Awesome. Look at that. So, you know, I can't get away from PowerPoints. I'm a very visual person, so I like to have things for people to look at, because I like to look at things. But anyway, I'm just going to give you, you had the talk already this morning, but I'm going to give you a little bit, a talk of how do I talk about single payer? Well, what is single payer? Single payer actually is just the financing mechanism for our healthcare. But what's important about that is that it's evidence-based. So when I said earlier that, you know, that PPAC or the federal reform, if it was put before a review board, it would fail because we already have the evidence that it's not going to work. We have decades of experience in this country. Outcomes are clear. Single payer is similarly evidence-based. We have research. We have evidence around the world, but also in our own country, looking at systems like the VA system and Medicare, that these principles work. What is it? I think I had this slide in my first presentation. It's a unified risk pool. That's really important because the more people, the larger the risk pool, the more we share the risk, the less it costs each of us overall. Everybody contributes. This is equity based on their ability to pay, progressive financing, simplified administration. I kind of went through all this earlier, so I don't want to go through it too much again. But that's what single payer really is. I think, actually, I had this one earlier, too, the single pool. All the dollars go in. It's really important to remember that 60% of our healthcare dollars are already publicly funded. So we're already spending more in public dollars alone per person per year than many of the other industrialized nations that cover everybody. So when people say, well, you're going to have to raise taxes, well, yeah, we would have to raise taxes if we want to spend at our current level of spending. But in taxes, we're already spending enough in healthcare dollars to cover everybody. We just need to put that into a single pool and use them efficiently. Let's see. A little bit that you might get asked, questions that you might get asked about legislation, and so this is talking about H.R. 676. Who is eligible? H.R. 676 says if you live in this country, you're eligible for care. That when you show up for care, you're presumed eligible, and the first thing you get is care. Right? What a novel idea. And the benefits are comprehensive. So all medically necessary care is covered. This includes prescription. It includes vision, dental, mental health, long-term care. You heard, was it Mr. Moreno that talked about the dental? I mean, in this country, across the board, our dental care is just, it's much lower. There's much lower access to dental care, and it's one of the greatest causes of suffering in this nation. And portability, that means that it goes with you wherever you go. So you don't have to worry about you lose your job, you lose your benefits. You don't have to worry about if you're traveling and you get sick that now you're out of network. So when you're in the national system, you're in that system everywhere you go around the country. Dr. Coates, who I work with from Albany, New York, says this is personal liberation. Single payer is personal liberation because you're free to choose the job that you want to choose without worrying about benefits, start your own business, travel, move, go to school, all those kinds of things we want to do. Let's see. We hear over and over again, we have to be incrementalists, right? Have you heard that term? We can't get there all at once. We have to be incremental towards single payer. Well, there isn't really an incremental towards single payer. The two things that we need in this country that are going to put us on the right path is one, a system. We don't have a coherent system in this country where we make decisions based on you know, our resources and how best to allocate them to improve the health of our population. And we need the money to pay for that system, and that's a publicly accountable, publicly financed, single-payer financing. Once we do that, it changes the whole game, because now we're talking about health, we're talking about looking at our needs and allocating our resources based on those needs, and now we can start making all the changes. You know, we've got tons of different programs in the U.S. that we can be used as models for how to, you know, how would we then deliver care, how would we then make sure that people have access to care where they are. Let's see, and this is all based on a paper called the Physicians Working Group Proposal. If you go to the PNHP website, pnhp.org, on the home page, middle column, scroll down a little bit, and you're going to see a link to the Physicians Working Group Proposal. It's not a very long paper. It was published in 2003 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it outlines it. It'll answer a lot of your questions about what it is that single payer is. All right. People say it's socialized medicine. So when they say that, I say it's civilized medicine. This is what civilized nations do for their people. It's socialized insurance. It's public financing, but it's private delivery. And to be honest, the VA is a socialized system, and it's one of the best systems that we have in this country. And Medicare is different from the VA. It's public financing, but private delivery. But it also, under Medicare, it's interesting. There was an article out recently looking at life expectancy in the United States. And the surprising thing is that once you make it to 65, you have a greater ability to live longer because now you're in Medicare. And actually, health disparities start to disappear once you hit the age of 65. All right. Let's see. Oops. Won't there be rationing under a single-payer system? Well, the truth is, we have rationing in this country, but it's the cruelest form of rationing that you could possibly have. It's rationing based on the ability to pay. They may say they may have lines in other countries, but in the United States, 51 million people can't even get in line. So this is just, this to me is devastating. This is the numbers of people that we know of with these chronic conditions that are uninsured, who are not able to get the care that they need. 54% of our chronically ill population is not getting adequate care. And isn't this rationing? 45,000 deaths of uninsured adults a year. And that's just uninsured adults, 2008 data. Let's see, can people purchase private insurance? People ask this over and over again. It's important for us to understand that if we allow the public plan and private plans to cover the same benefits, we undermine the public plan. That what one of the beauties of single payer is that every single one of us is in it. Every single one of us has a stake in defending it and making it the best program that it is. It raises the bar. It raises the quality of care. And if we look at Medicaid performs fairly poorly on health outcomes. It's a system for people that generally have no political voice. So when we create a single-payer system that we're all in, it raises that standard. Let's see. What about malpractice? People always say, well, don't we just have to fix malpractice? Single-payer addresses malpractice. About 50% of our malpractice cases go to court because people are concerned about the cost of ongoing care. That concern goes away under single-payer. The other issue is that it's really sad what's happened to this nation. Most of you are like my age or older, so we remember the time when you had the doctor that you knew and you went to that doctor over a long period of time and that doctor knew you and your family. That's really changed. When I was in medical practice, I left about 4 years ago, as a pediatrician, I had my patients, I met many of them on their first day of life. I had many families where, you know, I've met a lot of their kids on the first day of life and knew that family well. But if their parents changed jobs or their job changed insurance, I lost that family. They could no longer see me anymore. And we know that having that relationship, that continuity of care, it's invaluable because I knew which of my family's were very stoic and only really came in when things were pretty serious, and which one of them came in all the time, you know, and what was going on in their family and what might be contributing to their symptoms, that, you know, why they were coming in to see me. So this is really important. We have to get back to that health professional patient relationship that we've had before without these barriers that get in the way. And that, I think, will do a lot, long way towards addressing malpractice and then access to timely care. You know, if you can actually get care when you need it, you're better likely to have a better outcome and not suffer serious consequences that cause you to have ongoing costs of care, and then you're looking for somebody to sue so you can get money for that. All right, what about individual responsibility? This is another one that drives me absolutely crazy, because people say, well, we just need to have better health habits, right? I mean, could you just go out and have better health habits, and then we'd all be... There's been this ongoing trend in this country. It's with the cost of care, but it's also with the responsibility of care, of putting it on the individual. We shift more and more of the responsibility onto the individual. We live in a society, you heard about the social determinants of health, and I often talk about this, and I didn't because I knew the panel was coming on after me. We live in a society that has the greatest wealth inequality of all the industrialized nations, in which people don't have adequate education, and we know that education is tied to your level of health, where people don't have jobs with living wages, where people don't have access to clean, you know, healthy food in their community that's affordable. You know, there's concerns now about even clean water. What about the toxins that are in our environment? What about the fact that we subsidize the corn industry so that we have high fructose corn syrup in everything that we make? You know, we have a long way to go to address all of those problems before we start putting the blame on the individual. So finally, this is something that we can be proud of, and this is how I like to frame it, is that, you know, for me as a physician, for me to have the knowledge that we live in a country where we're already spending enough for it to cover everybody, but we're not doing it because we have this entrenched for-profit industry, I cannot be quiet. I cannot accept that. I cannot accept the number of people that are dying. As Mr. Moreno said, I can't live with that fact. I can't live with the number of people that are suffering, the number of people that are left out, without seeing that it's my responsibility to do something about that. So I think it's all of our responsibility if in this country to say that we can do a lot better. So I'm going to turn this over to Paul and Mike, and we traveled on the Mad as Hell Doctors. Maybe Paul will tell you a little bit about that. And each of us had kind of a different approach to talking about single payer healthcare. So they're going to share their wisdom and insight with you. All right.
I don't know how much wisdom I'm going to share, but I've got some thoughts. Before I get started, I just want to remind people why we think you're here, or why we'd like to think that you're here. And if all we do is talk to each other and say some really cool stuff and get a lot of applause, and everybody goes home feeling really good and righteous about being in favor of single payer or something that resembles single payer, we haven't accomplished anything. So the reason we're here is to give everybody here the courage and the tools to go home and make presentations in your own community and talk to your neighbors. And some of those neighbors are like some of my friends who are a little bit farther to the right of center. So it's really important to know how to engage those people in these discussions in a respectful way, to sort of nudge them and to give them things to think about. And sometimes, even if they don't say, you know, yes, you're right, if they're good friends and good people and they've got a good heart, some of the things you're going to say is going to have an impact on them. And it's going to move the discussion a little farther. So I know this is the choir, but how many people here think we have a broken healthcare system? That was a trick question. We don't have a healthcare system. And that actually is the point. And that's why we're spending twice as much and getting poor results. Okay? So before I start describing this healthcare factory that we have, I want to remind people that we're spending, as Margaret said, 60% of all of the healthcare dollars is already government taxpayer money. Additionally, the private insurance premiums that you're paying or your employer is paying are inflated by about 10 to 15% to cover the cost of the uninsured, people who can't pay their bills. The hospitals have to do this cost shifting, so prices, charges are higher, and everybody's paying higher prices. So even people that have private health insurance, part of their premium's paying for everybody else, right? And when people get sick and they end up in my emergency room and they don't have health care coverage, what do I do? Well, I take care of them, because it's the right thing to do and it's the law, and they end up in the ICU, and when they can't pay their bill, who pays it? We all do. So what we have is a $2.5 trillion healthcare factory, okay? And if you look inside this factory, what do you find? Well, you find a lot of economic entities: doctors, clinics, hospitals, pharmacies, drug companies, medical supply companies, insurance companies, we've got a few of those. And every one of those entities has a cadre of lawyers working for them. And the way you make as a provider, so these economic entities, what are they trying to accomplish? Are they trying to deliver high-quality health care as their primary goal? No, they're economic entities. This is a for-profit, consumer-driven, capitalistic healthcare model, and each of these economic entities is trying to make a buck. All right? Well, in our current non-system, the way providers, be they physicians or hospitals or clinics, the way these entities make the most money is they invoke very expensive technology that are marketed to them by the medical supply people and the innovators. And they use this very expensive technology to keep really sick people from dying, or in some cases, keep really sick people alive a little longer to suffer more. And I know everybody in this room is thinking of a specific story of somebody in their life who just that happened to, all right? It turns out you don't make much money in this non-system by keeping people healthy or keeping people with chronic diseases from falling into that 20% that was mentioned earlier that cost the most amount of money. All right? So the magic of the marketplace is we have a lot of really sick people to take care of. All right? And the way insurance companies make money in this system, this non-system, is how? Deny coverage. How else do they make money? Raise premiums. How else do they make money? You haven't mentioned the main reason they make money. The thing that's most critical to insurance companies making money is? They avoid sick people. They cherry pick. They avoid adverse selection. And so these are called risk pools, right? So more and more when I'm talking to people, I don't talk about single payer. Instead, I talk about single risk pool. Because if you think about how we segregate the country up into various risk pools in this country, and we waste 20% of all our healthcare dollars in the process of doing it, that's what having all these insurance companies cost us, right? Then you think about the risk pools we have. There's Medicare, Medicaid, the vets, the Native Americans, employed people, Congress people. Ouch. and then there's all the people that fall through the cracks, all right? Well, who pays Medicare is an abysmal risk pool because it's old people. Who pays for that? Taxpayer. Medicaid is an abysmal risk pool because it's disabled people and poor people and as we learned, health follows wealth, so poor people are unhealthy people. So the Medicaid population's an abysmal risk pool. Who pays for them? Taxpayer. What about the Native Americans? Taxpayer. What about the vets? Taxpayer. And then the taxpayer gives subsidies to the insurance companies, and PPACA is only going to make this more so, gives subsidies to the insurance companies to cover employed people who are statistically the healthiest. And then, of course, the people that fall through the cracks, we all pay for them anyway. So really, it's a giant taxpayer ripoff. And that's just... So that's just a way of thinking about how to talk to your neighbors. I think I'm done for now, because I think we'll get to a lot of question and answers later. Okay.
Watch a step. Okay. Hi, I'm Mike Huntington. Paul and I are the radicals from Corvallis. And I want to keep in mind our goal, and I hope your goal for today, and that is to come away with new passion, new energy, and new tools to speak with your neighbor, approach people that you might not normally approach, be a little bit of a pest, but be diplomatic about being a pest. And first, to do that, I think you need to find your source of passion. What was the passion that brought you here today? And I want to tell you what brought me into this fray with Paul and then Margaret and then others. And that was that I was a radiation oncologist in Corvallis. And between 1996 and 2006, I saw that our treatment cost tripled for certain cancers. And it was in the process of that tripling that we were already on the curve that was flattened. And we might have improved things a few percentage in outcomes or reduction in side effects with that tripling in cost. That's going from $24,000 to $66,000 in 10 years. So what happened to insurance premiums during that 10 years? Any relationship? It's not just the insurance companies that are inefficient and taking a fifth of our money away. It's we don't have a system that tells us when are we getting any value for this money that we're pumping into the system. So what would I see coming into our department would be people with advanced cancers, sometimes coming in through Paul's emergency room with bleeding, with obstruction of bowel or breathing, that they had neglected, quote unquote, because they felt they couldn't afford to see a physician. And they were right. In 1996, they could have. By 1999, they had seen the premiums go so high they could not afford them. By 2003, they would come to our cancer center, sometimes through the ER, with a crisis. And when I saw that happen, that's where my fire started going. I need to do something about this. And then one day Paul said, Mike, we got to do something about this. I'm seeing kids in the ER that have fallen off a trike, have a headache, and we're in the ER exam room, and if anybody in that room mentions MRI, I'm in a tough spot. I can spend 45 minutes explaining to the parents why that's not necessary, or I can spend 45 seconds writing out for an MRI. Now, if I do that second choice, I've done three things. I've satisfied the parents, I've cleared out my ER, and I've made my CEO happy. Is this a system we even want to identify with? So when you get your passion, then you get your tools, you get your stories like that one, or many that you have heard from your own family or from friends of people who have gone bankrupt. A million of us each year do that from medical costs, or people who have unnecessarily suffered, or families who have lost somebody because they didn't have insurance. And find your audience. You need to be aggressive. It could be your neighbors. It could be at work. And then be a pest. If it's somebody that's already in the choir, you're approaching them. One purpose is to give them more tools, more ideas they can use when they talk with people. That's what we're doing right now. You're increasing the network. You're building a network. And we're doing that in Corvallis and around the state this month and next month. And so you're doing two things for the choir. You're encouraging them, giving them more tools. That's what we're doing right now. And then there's the people on the fence. And so know your audience, right? So how do you approach somebody that you know is very conservative, very worried about too much government? Well, you can appeal to that interest. You can say, family values. Let's talk about family values. So what happens to families when the breadwinner or anybody in that family gets an illness that bankrupts the family? What happens when premiums are so high that the parents have to choose which child to insure? So family values, while we were on tour last year, a family in our town, there was a man in his 50s with an advanced cervical cancer who was being faced with a dilemma. Even with the best of surgery, radiation therapy, and chemotherapy, his outlook was not very good. So he and his wife were having a conversation while the children were in the next room saying, honey, I don't think I want to put our family through this risk. We could lose our house. We could lose everything for a result that we're not sure of. Those conversations are going on daily in this town, around our nation. So there's an approach to one audience, somebody who's thinking family values. How about to someone who fears government? Well, you already have plenty of answers there. And if you want to get Abraham Lincoln's take on this, just Google Abraham Lincoln, role of government. And you will find that back then, as a Republican, he said, there are things that we cannot do for ourselves or do it very well for which we need government. Building bridges, a legal system, and now who can do for themselves their own health care? Each one of us is one illness away from bankruptcy. Doesn't matter who we are. We need government to help us. Free enterprise. When we were in Nashville, we were demonstrating in front of Healthcare Hospital Corporation of America, and there were 100 of us single-payer people yelling at the building, and there was a little crowd of 21 tea partiers, and I felt sorry for them, so I joined them. So I had my white coat on, and they were yelling, no more bureaucracy, because they don't want the federal government with its bureaucracy. And before they could say bureaucracy, I would say, insurance, insurance. And they turned around and smiled. Said, we don't want insurance between us and our doctors either. One lady was holding a manufactured death panel sign, something that had been placed in her hand. I said, do you know what that's about? And she said, no. I said, well, this allows physicians to get paid for counseling you about end-of-life issues. Oh. And then another man said, are you against free enterprise? He was a big guy. He was looking down at me. And I said, no. And he said, well, if you have the government involved, you're going to destroy free enterprise. And I said, look, the biggest thing I see interfering with free enterprise is the very able engineer or the person who could be a organic farmer who's afraid to leave his dumb, dull job with HP. Anybody here from HP? Because they know they will not be able to afford health insurance. Talk about smashing entrepreneurism. And he said, I'm a poster child for that. Suddenly I felt I was not going to get killed. And then freedom of choice. That's pretty easy. I mean, Anybody knows that your insurance company is chosen by your employer, and that employer may change insurers every 3 years. The average length of stay for somebody under insurance plan is about 4 years. And Margaret mentioned, what about continuity there? Probably the most important thing about primary care is continuity. So we don't have that. And then you'll have the audience that you'll just smile and say, we'll agree to disagree. And there is an insurance broker in Corvallis who I think will reach that agreement. There is one in this room, however, who is a strong single-payer supporter. So that's not all insurance people are against single-payer. But for some, you will have to say, we'll agree to disagree. And there's a quote from the fellow whose name I can't come up with right now. You cannot convince somebody of something if his salary depends on not understanding it. So, okay, you cannot convince somebody of something if his salary depends on not understanding it. So you may have to just write off certain people, and you have to be smart enough to choose which ones to invest your energy. Well, that's what I have for right now. We're open for questions.
I forgot to say a few things. I could go on forever, actually. So, you know, being in favor of single payer or single risk pool, whatever we want to call it, is not about being bleeding heart liberal. It's about money. It's about getting value for the money we're spending on healthcare. Okay? And it's a lot cheaper for all of us to create a system so that all of the diabetics can get their insulin and all of the hypertensives can get their hypertensive medications than it is for us to pay for those people when they show up in my emergency room and then end up in the ICU. It's not about being bleeding heart liberal. It's just about being fiscally responsible and smart. Okay? So I have another question for you, and I promise maybe that it's not a trick question. And that is, you know, during the great healthcare reform debate that wasn't, one of the possibilities that kept bubbling to the surface was the public plan option. And so how many people were feeling at the end of this debate, discussion, debacle, that they were disappointed that at least we didn't get the public plan? It is another trick question. The public plan option, yeah. The public option is just another insurance company. It's just another insurance company. It's a public insurance company, publicly owned, publicly operated. One would hope it had ethics. It really did take all comers. It didn't try to tweak the rules to just find the people that were low risk, which is how the insurance companies make money. Remember that? So if we had the public option, what would happen with almost 100% certainty is that the for-profit and nominally not-for-profit insurance companies, not-for-profit, would continue to do everything they can possibly do to appeal to the low-risk people. They would put their enrollment centers in athletic clubs. They would put their enrollment centers on the second floor of buildings that don't have elevators. Well, this is real stuff. And so what would happen is that the public option would be like a gravity hole, and all of the sickest, most expensive patients would gravitate to the public option. And when the public option 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road, we're now talking 2018, whatever, really was struggling, not because they were incompetent, not because they had excessive bureaucracy, but because they were doing it ethically and because they were subject to adverse selection. And now our $2.5 trillion factory was $3.5 trillion. All right? And it was pretty clear to everybody that we really needed to do something real to take care of it. The opponents of the what we think is the only sustainable solution, which is something that resembles single risk pool, they would point at the public option, and they would successfully convince the public that, see, the government can't do health care. I know, but I think that would be the worst possible outcome for us to have a public plan option, because it would be designed to fail. And I think there are a lot of people who agree with that in PNHP. It's still controversial. So now I think we're going to do stump the chumps.
It's not just that the public option would fail. It's that it's adding one more insurance company to all the insurance companies that we have, so it still doesn't address the fundamental problem, which is that we need a universal, coherent healthcare system, and we need to use our healthcare dollars in a efficient, responsible way so that we have the money to pay for healthcare. Because we can't get the savings we need by adding one more insurance program. The savings we get is by having a system that with a simplified administration where there's one entity that we deal with. So it's been tried. It failed for the reasons that Paul outlined, and it just doesn't address the fundamental issues that we have. And that's why that we don't see the public option as anything that we can support. But you're making a face. Do you want to come to the microphone for that? And this is just, I was on KPOJ yesterday morning, and this question, the one call we got was a caller asking about the public option. So I don't think this issue has gone away, so I think it's important for us to understand why we haven't supported it.
I haven't done my homework on the public policy option, okay?
Step forward.
I haven't done my homework on the public policy option. What I was trying to understand on a systems level was when you say that would be designed to fail, then how is the single payer system, even if you don't have its platform on insurance companies, which fine by me, okay, how are you going to take the contributions into the single payer system, and who is going to manage those funds that they get dispersed in an equitable fashion, knowing full well what your demographic coverage is going to be? We're going to assume that you have electronic medical records and economist demographics administrating your board, and who's going to be the check and balance on that, ensuring that equity as an independent organization. I say this in due respect. I assure you I'm a vetted medical service provider. Okay. My concern is that I know the two-tiered system to reduce drug costs has failed. I know between 1997 and 2002, one in six public hospital safety nets were closed. I also know that nonprofits in 1997 had to compete with for-profits for government service contracts, of which we all know the medical system depends 60% on the dollars. And I'm only asking those questions of single payers that I asked ultimately of our same structure today, where 60% of our public funds go into Medicare, Medicaid, to say, SSI, and that. And where are the websites for transparency so we can see where these are going, so we can send people there just to look at the data themselves without being considered political? Because without policy, it does become politics. It doesn't mean one is political. Thank you for listening.
Sure. I guess there was a lot of information in that, and thank you. I do refer people to the Physicians Working Group paper because it does outline a lot of how we envision a single-payer system working. And one of the things that we haven't talked about, we've been talking a lot about the cost savings and the financial part of this, but there's the other part of this, which is the healthcare as a human right part. And the five principles of human rights are universality, equity, accountability, transparency, and participation. So participation is important. That means that we have a say in how our health dollars are used. And we're the only industrialized nation that doesn't use a human rights model for their health care. So a big part of the single-payer system is creating these regional planning boards that have a diverse input. You know, they have it's health professionals, but it's business people, it's advocates, it's people in the community who then have some voice into how that health system is, how it functions in their community, and have a public avenue for their grievances and for saying, you know, hey, this is not working here, we need to look at this. This is the beauty of having a system, because things change, right? And if you have a system, you can tweak that system to deal with the changes that are happening. France, which has one of the best health systems in the world, is constantly evolving their health system. They have this really beautiful process. I worked with a woman, and her husband was a surgeon in France, and she consulted to the French health system. And each year, they would get these, you know, input. You know, the farmers are saying that they're not able to get, blah, you know, this. So they say, here's the problem, here are different solutions, and then they would choose the solution they thought would work the best. So they were constantly tweaking that system, and that's what happens when you have an actual system. So I know just maybe a little bit of what you're saying, and I'm not sure I got everything that you were saying, but I'm happy to talk about it more. All right, so we're going to do Stump the Chump?
One more. I need to say this every time I have an opportunity, and that is that the physician community is way more culpable in this disaster than anybody's willing to talk about. That we make a pretty darn good living working in the heart of the dragon. And that we're not bad people, but we're responding to terribly perverse incentives. And there's nobody in the current non-system that's asking the question, how do we get value for, how do we use our precious resources to get the most health we can for our healthcare dollars? Okay? And so it's not just about bashing the insurance companies, okay? Maybe we can save 20% of all of our dollars right off the top by going to a single risk pool. But we spend twice as much as the rest of the industrialized world. So where's the rest of it? Well, the rest of it is in the perverse incentives, okay? There's a video called Health, Money, and Fear that you can get down at the P&HP table downstairs that methodically goes through all the reasons why healthcare costs so much. And it basically blames everybody. But it's really important to understand all of those perverse incentives to really understand how this non-system doesn't work. Yeah, questions?
Let me just say I have an accounting background, and so obviously cost-benefit is, you know, something that I understand really a lot. And, you know, after listening to this for 10 minutes, you can obviously see the cost, you know, benefit of going to a single payer plan. We all understand that. We have a lot of smart people in Congress. Why don't they get it?
That's an easy answer.
Well, that I had direct experience with that in 2009 and 2010. They don't get it because the entities that profit off of the status quo also control the political process through their dollars and control the message that people hear through our corporate media. And so I said earlier that this was a matter of professional integrity for me. I want you guys to understand that I'm just like every single one of you. I was a mom, I still am, three kids, living in Maryland when the health reform process started and decided to get involved with it through P&HP. And when we did all the things we were supposed to do, we met with our members of Congress, we did emails and call-ins and all these things to try to get single payer on the table. We used the president's own words about his support for single payer to show him that, hey, we expected him to include this. And when it came down to it, and the first committee was meeting, and they had 41 people invited to testify over 3 days. The people they invited were the health insurance CEOs, the health insurance lobbyists, the pharmaceutical lobbyists, the Chamber of Commerce, the business roundtable. There was nobody there speaking for the majority of the population, which wants a single-payer system. So what did it take to change that? Eight of us, and you have Mark Dudzik is here, and Katie's coming later, three physicians, two lawyers, and three health advocates, went down to that committee, and we stood up in front of the C-SPAN cameras and the tables of press and said, so that's what it takes. It takes all of our things. It takes the advocacy and the education and the organization, but it also takes not accepting that we're being excluded and doing what you can to expose that and stand up and fight for us to be put on the table, because single payer is never going to get on the table. We have to put it on the table. So that's what we have to be willing to do.
I feel like now my stump the chump question revolves around jobs, because I feel like that's been a big issue right now in the media and everything, jobs. How would you respond to someone's concern about, you know, if we move to a single-payer system and, you know, right now a huge percentage of our GDP is devoted to healthcare, but if we have this more efficient system, we're not using the medical billers or the techs or everything like that, where are they going to work? And I feel like that's a question I've gotten from somebody, and how would you guys respond to that?
Do you want me to, or do you guys want to? Okay, sure. Okay, so the jobs picture, we have to look at the big picture. There's one piece, which is the people that currently work in the health industry. I don't have the numbers, but people have moved from direct patient care as a result of their frustration with the current situation into administrative positions in these companies. We have a direct patient care shortage. So under a single-payer system, ideally some of those people, like myself, I didn't go to work for the industry, but I left practice out of my frustration. Under a single-payer system, I would go back into practice, and so would the nurses who work in the utilization review departments and hospitals could go back into practice and things like that. The legislation also says that for people who are displaced from employment, they're the first ones rehired into the new system because we still need people, and if they don't get that, they get job retraining. But let's look at the bigger picture of what's happening in this country. When you have somebody who has an idea to start a small business, but they can't go and do it because they can't afford the health benefits if they go out on their own, they could go out and start a business and create jobs. What happens when families are no longer spending 25 or 30% of their income on health care and can actually now have greater discretionary income to go out and put into the economy? What happens when our businesses in this country, our large businesses, are not hampered by health care costs that don't allow them to compete on the global market? So you can argue that, there was one study done by the California Nurses Association which actually said that if we put all these factors together, single payer is a job creator and would create 2.6 million new jobs. So it's a stimulus package and a job creator. And the deficit commission, you guys know the deficit commission last year? That was a lot of my work this summer and fall, was fighting the deficit commission. And the argument that we were making to our members of Congress and to the commission and to the people is that our economy, it really is, it's about healthcare, stupid. You know, it's hurting our economy in so many ways. And the answer is to fix our healthcare with a single payer system. It just has ripple effects that go out into the whole economy. So I don't know if that helped. Did you have anything? Okay, cool. Screw stigma. All right.
Hi. I have a question about innovation in the healthcare field in general, medical equipment, pharmaceuticals, all that kind of stuff. One of the big arguments I always hear against single payer is that all that innovation comes from the profit motive. So what do you say to people who say that?
So my big concern about the innovation that we have right now in terms of the pharmaceutical industry and the medical device industry is it's about what can they create to make a profit off of, not what can we create to address a problem that we have in our society or to create something that we don't have. The majority of new drugs are taking drugs we currently have, tweaking the chemical structure a little bit, giving it a new name with a patent, and then marketing it very heavily. 40% of their dollars go into marketing. And we don't have the proof. They don't even have to prove whether this new entity is superior to what we already have. So when you have a single-payer system, now we're the ones that are, as a single purchaser, as a monopsony, the system is determining what our priorities are. And so you can say, we have this problem. We have this illness, and we need to find a solution to it. Now businesses can start trying to find solutions to that so that they compete to be the one that gets our business. So it's driving innovation in a direction that improves our health rather than just being this whole mishmash of what can we create and then market. You know, a lot of these medical devices, we don't have proof of whether they actually improve health outcomes, but they're very aggressive about getting into physician offices and trying to convince individual physicians who are really busy and don't have time to do all the research to figure out whether it's better than what we have. To use their products. Now we're driving what those products are going to be, and there's still a market for them. There's actually a great market. If you figure that a lot of people can't afford drugs because they don't have the money to pay for them under the single-payer system, now that drug company gets all of the customers, you know, but they have to have a product that improves our health. That makes sense.
This gets into the whole discussion of rationing, actually. But the reasons hospitals adopt new technologies today is because of market share and because it's really profitable. And that a lot of the new technologies, Mike was, whatever, a lot of these are on the flat of the curve. You get new technologies that increase outcomes by 1 or 2%. That cost phenomenal amount of money. And they get adopted because they get paid for. Having a single-payer system, having a single risk pool administered by an overview committee, the people that are making the decisions are public health people, hospital administrator types, medical economists. And they're going to be making some very difficult decisions about not whether a procedure or a new technology is just meets the measure of risk of cost of risk benefit. Doctors are trained in risk benefit. We're not trained in cost benefit. But we're all paying for everybody anyway. So when we invoke technologies that have minimal benefit, in the risk benefit analysis, but it's positive, we'll use it every time, even if those $100,000 or $200,000 might be better off funding community clinics, which creates more health and actually is a better investment of our precious healthcare dollars. It's a rationing discussion that nobody wants to talk about, but that's a long answer to your short question. Yeah.
I think the Democratic and Republican parties have been playing good cop, bad cop for a long time. And I want to know how we might possibly get around that. And I'm wondering if, because I think the only way the Democrats will move forward if they believe there is a real threat from their progressive flank. I can't think of a better way to convince them of that than a third-party challenge with healthcare, national health plan, a good healthcare plan as the foundation platform. And I think that issue is an issue which potentially can unite Republicans and Democrats, which is a catastrophic issue for everyone in this country. If explained honestly, actually is transparent and makes so much. I mean, it's simple. It's simple. It takes a lot of smoke and mirrors. And it takes like a 1,500-page plan in Congress to conceal the fact that this is very simple. And what I really would like to see, in fact, I even have a name which I offer to anyone who's not working for the health insurance industry. And it's the Healthy America Party. Are you happy? I'm happy because I see a future for this country where people's medical needs, their mental health needs, etc. So I would like to ask if there's other people here or if you on the panel agree with that. And I cannot think of any people better suited to speak for and to run on this party platform than physicians, provided they don't have cocaine habits in their past. And probably they've been too busy, you know, to get into much trouble. They have credibility, and that's really what I would like to see. Dr. Margaret Flowers as the presidential candidate. I would like to see physicians spearheading this. And I just think that that could really move the, like, wake people in Congress up and maybe nudge the Democratic Party and the people. Thank you.
Yeah, this healthcare, this whole healthcare reform debate is not about healthcare, really. It's just the poster child for the corrupt, broken political process. When we were on the road, somebody said, we don't have elections in this country. We have auctions. Hi, Betty.
Hi there. Good to see you. I wanted to know if you could ask all the speakers from today if they would put in just an outline of their talk on an internet site that we could access to make sure that we've hit all the points. For example, I can't even remember what the five principles of human rights were that you mentioned, and I'd love to just have them down, and then I would, oh, I know what that means. That's one. Two, I thought of another argument that we could use when you're trying to convince somebody who refers to all of us as bleeding heart liberals, and that is, there is something called a herd immunity that we tried to push during the flu season when we were trying to get everybody to get their flu vaccination. In this world, when people travel so much from one country to another, it is critical that we can depend that the person sitting next to us or our child at school is healthy and has the best access to medical care, so that we don't get their diseases. So I think that's one thing we could say. And the third question that I had, though, was, I know that France has a wonderful system. You mentioned that, Margaret. They don't have a single payer system. I thought they had some sort of insurance pool system. Is that right? Okay. Thank you.
The issue about herd immunity, when we were traveling in California as the Madison doctors last fall, this fall, there's a pertussis whooping cough epidemic in Southern California, and Southern California was put on Canada's travel advisory, just like it was a third world country.
The France question. Sorry, I was emailing my buddies that I work with in D.C., my political buddies, about Happy Party. It's like, I like the Happy Party. That's cool. Because I agree with you that, and that's why I say our movement has to be independent of politics. And I don't mean don't elect people to offices, but we have to be willing to hold them accountable when they get into office, no matter what their party is. But and we need to challenge the parties to move them in our direction. France has a national health system that everybody is in the country, including the immigrant population, documented or not, that all care goes through that system first. It's a single-payer system. They have a quasi-governmental agency that runs that, and it's funded through employer contributions and a value-added tax. And then things that are not covered by that are covered by supplemental insurance, which about 95% of the French population has a supplemental but it's what's called a mutual. It's a nonprofit, heavily regulated, very inexpensive insurance policy that is a secondary policy to the national health systems.
So, thank you.
Sure. And but wasn't there one other thing besides France? So the OregonSinglePayer.org, can we put some of our presentations and things? Yeah, I mean, PNHP.org has an excellent, I mean, if you go there, there's tons of resources there. And if you have questions, one thing I do keep up with is my email. So email me at margaret@pnhp.org if you have a question. And if you can't find it, like at pnhp.org, or you can't find it at healthcare-now.org, which is another good site, then contact me, margaret@pnhp.org, and ask me your question. So.
How likely are we to get waivers from the federal government if we try to do this on a state-by-state basis? It seems like that's going to be a big issue.
Yeah, that's a great question. In order to do single payer at the state level, you have to get certain waivers from the federal government and from the Department of Health and Human Services that allow us to use our federal health care dollars for this single payer system. There's other types of things that we need to get. We have members of Congress that are dedicated to helping us fight for those waivers in both the Senate and the House. The one thing that gives me real hope is that there was one amendment in the whole health reform process that passed with bipartisan support. Does anybody know what that amendment was? It was the Kucinich Amendment, an educational and labor that would grant some of the waivers to states to do single-payer programs. Because then it becomes the issue of states' rights. Because would you deny a state the right to try their own health system that's at least as good as the federal health system? That's a pretty powerful argument. And we're going to need to make that fight. If we want to do this at the single payer at the state level, we have to be willing at the national level, all the states, to put pressure on Congress to fight for those waivers. And that's one thing that's come out of the reform process with the state effort is that there is now kind of a national state single payer group that meets regularly by conference call. And so we're willing to work with each other to fight for that. It didn't get into the final legislation. It was such a bummer. It got pulled out during the kind of the leadership when they were doing the final bill. They pulled it out. But it was called the Kucinich Amendment, and it was education and labor that it passed in. And I'm sorry I don't have the number. I've got it in my computer if you contact me.
On election night, when most people were watching returns, our OPB played a front line about the backroom deals that gave us what has the very diluted system that became known as Obamacare, the forces which meant that your presence at the table was both unwanted and aborted, and thank you so much for being there. My question is, can we expect this kind of these forces at the state level? And if so, how do we adequately arm ourselves for what can be a very nasty battle?
Thank you. Thank you. So we can absolutely expect the forces of opposition to be coming out at the state level. They already do. I work our state bill in Maryland, and I get followed by the health insurance lobbyists. It's immunity. Actually, it's how do we immunize the population against the propaganda that's going to be put out by the industry about single payer? We immunize the population through education. If people are in our communities are educated and know what single payer is, they're not going to buy into that propaganda. So that's one thing that's really important. But then the other is that we have to be organized. And I think part of the goal of this conference is to develop citizen lobbyist groups so that you're organized in your legislative district to have a relationship with your legislator and to build the political power that you need in your own legislative district to hold them accountable. Because corporations have money, but we have the votes. We're never going to have the money that they have, but we have the power of the vote. And if you walk into your legislative district and you say, I've got 3,000 people in your district that will only vote for you if you do these things for single payer, that's a very powerful, that's a huge amount of political power that you have. So it's really important that we organize and educate. And I don't want to hum this. If you guys jump up here, just knock me off the podium. Okay, cool.
Quick
Quick, simple question. How do we counter the entitlement meme?
The entitlement. Okay, so I hate that word, entitlement.
So do I.
So one thing we do is we don't use the word entitlement. We talk about our social insurances. Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid are social insurance programs that have been very successful to lift those populations out of poverty and to improve the status of their health. As a nation, compared to the other industrialized nation, we invest a very small proportion of our GDP into social infrastructure, into supporting our society. And we actually have... We don't compare very well to the other nations as a result of that. One of my favorite articles is called "The American Dream is Alive and Well in Finland." Because Finland actually supports their people, and so they actually have upward mobility, and their economy is growing, and they have a good standard of living. So it's about social insurances, not entitlement. It's about what a civilized society does to empower its citizenry to be productive, healthy people. So that's it.
Okay, my question is about finances.
Okay.
I worked in the hospital for 35 years, and so all these tests that we do are so inflated in cost to cover all these other things, but yet in other countries they're so much lower. How is that going to come down so that the single payer can afford to pay that?
Right. So that's part of the problem that we have in this country, and the way that we differ is that we absolutely micromanage our health care. We require payment for every little thing. Every aspirin, every Band-Aid has a charge. Every test, there's a charge attached to each of these. And that's a ridiculous way to pay for health care. What makes more sense is to do it on a global budgeting level, where your hospital, and this would mean that that public hospitals wouldn't be closing down, because every hospital that's deemed to be necessary, because now we're going to look at the population and their needs, and we're going to say, well, we don't need 5 hospitals in this area and no hospitals over here. We need 3 hospitals in this area, and we'll move 2 over here. But each hospital would get a global budget that would allow them to take care of their population. And so now it's just about, you know, if the truth is that patients and healthcare professionals generally make good decisions if they're not in this environment that drives them to do procedures for profit. They make pretty good decisions about what to use and what not to use. And so when you're just paying at a global level where the hospital is just getting a set amount of money each month that's determined based on their need, then you're not it's not tied to that individual test. That's how they do it in Canada.
Okay.
And they don't need hundreds of billing people in Canada. They actually, there's like half of the billing people at the hospitals in Canada are actually there to deal with Americans that cross the border.
Thank you. I just have a little word of caution. I'm a healthcare provider, and I've also been a legislator. And you need to realize that politicians lead parades. They don't create parades, they lead them. And I would challenge a little bit that the majority of the people in the United States want a single-payer plan, because the numbers aren't there yet. And that's why we have everybody in this room, is to get those numbers there so these politicians can lead those parades and they can be proud of that they're doing it, even though we did all of the work. But my caution is that there are good things in the new Patient Care Act that are important. If we buy everybody a ticket to the health care system we have right now, we're buying them a ticket to the Titanic. So we need to be careful that we preserve the positive things in the healthcare pre-existing conditions and everything that's in the healthcare plan without demonizing those politicians who had to make those tough practical decisions when they were making those decisions. But I can tell you, as a legislator, when I would get single payer in my office or in front of the healthcare committee, and they were damning all of us, and they were saying we're all terrible, even though I'm a critical care nurse and I was working to do the best that I could do, they turned me off. I mean, it's like, okay, I can't listen to you anymore because all you're doing is making me the bad guy. So I'm just a cautionary tale that the insurance companies and the drug companies and the people that have the money in the healthcare system would like nothing more than to see everything get derailed, that we all spend the next 10 years fighting with each other and we don't move forward. So I encourage us to be very positive when we move forward and very positive for the people that are trying to make the changes in a really tough system.
Yeah. So that's great points. The polls show that the majority of people are already with us. It's how do we activate them and get them out into those parades to enable you to do the work that you need to do as a legislator and to be able to give you the backing where you can say to your colleagues, and they're hearing the same thing, is that this is what my district wants. In Vermont, single payer became politically feasible because they did incredible on-the-ground organizing, and the Democratic primary became a fight for who was the biggest single-payer supporter. And now even Senator Leahy is a single-payer supporter because it's politically unpopular in Vermont to not support single-payer.
Right.
So we create that through our grassroots work.
Right. The people have to empower the politicians. That's our job.
I would say the politicians need to show some leadership. And when we're not going to have any more questions because we're already run over. I want to make one more comment, then Mike's going to make a comment. But when President Obama said that, don't worry, all you people that have insurance that like it don't have to give it up, what he didn't say was if you don't like it, you have to keep it. But what I would have preferred him to say is to show some courage and some leadership and say that if we put everybody into the same risk pool, we will have enough savings so that we can cover everybody. And that there are some people out there with really, really good insurance policies that may have to ratchet down their expectations a little bit. But is it too much to ask of people in the community to say, you know, you may have to wait a little longer for your new knee or your new hip or your arthroscopy. But what you get for that is that every one of your neighbors gets what they need when they need it so that they don't suffer so much and it saves us all a whole bunch of money. And that's what I think a courageous politician would say. So Mike's going to make an announcement, and then he's going to do his thing.
We want to honor Representative Conyers, who flew 3,000 miles. How many miles? 12 hours on Frontier Airlines. The reason I mention that is that we need to be back here at 1 o'clock for his presentation. But before we go, I would like you to do a little exercise with me. How many of you have been in Boy Scout or Girl Scout? Okay. And do you remember using a pledge on my honor as a scout? Well, I'd like you to hold up one finger, the index finger, please, and repeat after me. As a reminder of what single payer is and what we all need to do. On my honor, as a healthcare advocate, I will do all within my power to create a healthcare system that uses all funds, public and private, to cover everyone until death do us part.